This is State of the Union, the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. District Council 37 is the city's largest public employee union with 125,000 members and nearly 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available as a podcast. Just go to the podcast app on your smartphone and look up DC 37 State of the Union. There are now more ways to stay in touch with the union than ever before. You can follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You should always go to our website, www.dc37.net. And if you have a comment about this show or any issue that you want to talk about, contact us at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. That's stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Our first guest this evening is George Lakey, who is an activist, sociologist, and writer. He is the author of a book called How We Win, A Guide to Nonviolent Direct Action Campaigning. Welcome to State of the Union, Mr. Lakey.
Thanks for inviting me.
I was looking at your. I should first begin by saying you are the author of How We Win, but you're also the author of a number of books.
Truth.
And I was looking at something that was written about How We Win, and in the publisher's website, it said that the Women's March of January 21st, 2017 was estimated at 4 million people, the largest assembly of activist protest in U.S. history. Many of those assembled were in the streets for the first time or returning after a period of inactivity. Could you tell me what you think the impact of the Women's March has been? And what is the right follow-up to continue that kind of impact?
Well, the grand thing about one of these massive turnouts, and the Women's March is a great example, as you said, the largest, according to a political scientist who's been keeping track of these things, the largest we've had in the U.S. The great thing about that is that it can inspire people to go on to do other things that require actual organizing and ongoing change. And I believe that it did that with regard that one of the outcomes was way more women's participation in the electoral process, for example. On the other hand, a lot of people misunderstand in the impact of those by imagining that by sending that kind of signal to the establishment, that it moves the establishment itself to alter its behavior. And that I don't believe at all. I don't think, in other words, that 4 million people turning out one day then changes policies and structures as a result. It doesn't do that because the opponent that we're dealing with, the economic elite in our country that stands behind the, you know, politicians who run things, it knows perfectly well that we're going to leave at the end of the day.
Right.
And we'll go home, and they continue their policies. And so that's why I wrote the book. That's one reason I wrote the book, was to point out that it's actual campaigning going forward that puts escalating pressure such that we get changes in policies.
And, you know, with social media, you see so much energy expended on the event. And I am not trying to say that the event in itself is not worthy. I'm simply saying that so much energy and so much buildup to an event such as the Women's March, and it's almost as if all that energy gets expended, and then what?
And then what? Exactly. So I went to that first one. I went also to the second one a year later. But I was particularly unhappy at the second one because I was thinking exactly as you are. What if all that energy that went into the one-year anniversary of the first one had instead gone into campaigning? Because it's actual. I mean, the labor movement knows that. You can do a token strike. But that doesn't really change the employer's policy. What really matters is to go on an extended strike. It's that kind of direct action that that produces mounting pressure and therefore gets a settlement that's more in our favor.
You know, I don't think I know I did not do justice to your activist career. It says on your bio on Wikipedia, in the late 1950s, Lakey was active in the Ban the Bomb movement. Sir, you have been doing this a long time, and how do you keep your energy?
A long time. Well, part of it is that I do take care of myself. That is, I know when I'm getting, you know, to the point of exhaustion, and then I stop and I rest and I do other things so that it helps me to stay in for the long run. And I think that's true of all the really veteran labor organizers that I've met, and I've worked with labor a lot over the years, that they sustain themselves partly by taking care of themselves. And also, an additional factor is having a support group or a support network of comrades who are human sensitive, you could say.
Right, right.
Who really tune in to you and who can, when I forget, to take care of myself, can say, George, tell me about your last 2 weeks, and is that any way to lead a life?
Well, I also, you know, we have an expression in the movement, the struggle continues. You've witnessed a lot of struggles, and you've been involved in a lot of struggles. And to keep a positive attitude in the year 2019 is going to be an interesting, how do you do that? I mean, where do you put where we are now in comparison to previous struggles that you have experienced and been involved with?
Yeah, well, one of the things I learned from participation in the civil rights movement, which was where I was first arrested long ago in a civil rights sit-in, one of the things I learned was that after Dr. King spent an intense day, you know, out on the streets, many people being beaten up and arrested and so on, and if he wasn't arrested, if he got to go back to the motel at night with his colleagues, they would have a pillow fight. And I learned, oh, right, I can punch that pillow, because I get furious, you know, at I think anybody who's in touch with the degree of exploitation and oppression that's going on, we get furious, and especially these times, and it doesn't do any good to just express that fury on the streets, because we need to do what really needs to be done rather than just do self-expression. But then we need to follow Dr. King, I think, and have those pillow fights, or, you know, do that screaming and crying and whatever it is we need to do to take care of ourselves emotionally. And these are amazing times. I'm 81 years old. When I look back over my lifespan, I would frankly say, and I'm a researcher, you know, I have made my living teaching in colleges and doing research. I would say that this is the most opportune time we've had in my lifetime to make major change. That is, bigger change than we were able to in the 1930s, although that wasn't an important part of, I mean, that was a leap forward in terms of the first half of the 20th century, and also bigger change than we were able to make in the 60s and 70s. This is the biggest moment, and I think it's partly because the legitimacy of government is not what it was in the 60s and 70s and not what it was in the 30s. That is, in those days, people actually believed that the government would come through for them and that the government was capable of doing things like eradicating poverty and dealing with racism adequately and so on. And now there's widespread disillusionment with the government, and political scientists will tell you when the government itself becomes starts to lose its legitimacy, that's when larger movements, more willing to go farther, can make a difference. And that's why I wrote the book, because the book kind of charts a way, it develops a path for how we can make the biggest changes that I've seen in my lifetime.
We're talking with George Lakey. He is the author of How We Win, A Guide to Nonviolent Direct Action Campaigning. We've got a few minutes left. I'd always like to tell my guests how much time we have left on this, in the segment. What are the key, I mean, I'm fascinated by the idea that you see opportunity here, unprecedented opportunity here. I'm wondering what steps you want to take or you believe can be taken in the immediate future and throughout the next 10 years.
The immediate future, from my point of view, is to double down on doing nonviolent direct action campaigns, focusing on economic entities for the most part. Sometimes it can be okay to go after a politician, but especially to go after the economic entities that are, in fact, you know, standing behind the politicians and manipulating and controlling them. And so, for example, I led a successful campaign to tackle the seventh largest bank in the United States that was financing. It was the leading financer of mountaintop removal coal mining in Appalachia, which was doubling cancer rates in the area. It was very, very hard on working class families, very hard on everybody. And we were able to, through a nonviolent direct action campaign, even though we started with a living room of people, that's all we started with, we were able to grow to 13 states and force that bank to give up financing mountaintop removal coal mining. I tell that story in my book along with other stories like the, you know, Flint and Detroit, Michigan, emergence of the United Auto Workers and so on. I tell the stories in order to show the enormous power that can be amassed through nonviolent direct action. But the book goes on beyond the campaign level. It tells how to do successful campaigns, how we win, but also how the campaigns then build movements, because a movement is bigger than a campaign. A movement is a constellation of campaigns, whether it's the sit-in movement or the sit-down movement of the 30s or whatever. And then once you've got movements going, the biggest and hardest question, and I address this in the book, is how to get the movements to work together so that we have an aggregate force in our country big enough to push the economic elite out of its dominance and be able to create an actual democracy. And once we've accomplished that, and I tell how to do that, then we're in a whole new ballgame. We're no longer being pushed around by the economic elite that always gets its way sooner or later. But instead, we're able to be in charge. We, the people, can actually have a democracy.
George Lakey is has been active in direct action campaigns for six decades. He's recently retired from Swarthmore College, where he was the Eugene M. Lang Visiting Professor for Issues in Social Change. He is the author of How We Win, A Guide to Nonviolent Direct Action Campaigning. I want to thank you, sir, for being with us on this show. And I want to hopefully continue the conversation ahead. I hope you'll come back and talk some more about the world in which we live.
I'd enjoy that.
Thank you very much, and we'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We'll be right back. We're back. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. My next guest is Stephen Greenhouse, former New York Times labor reporter and the author of a book that's coming out in August called Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Nice to be here, Chris.
I wanted to talk to you about you've been busy, actually. I mean, in addition to writing a book, I've seen, I think, three stories recently in the American Prospect, one of which was called New York Labor Didn't Shrink from Confronting Amazon. And the subhead is, but the unions were divided about how to deal with the tech giant. And there's been a lot of talk, a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking, a lot of analysis about the what happened with Amazon. And I wanted to focus on, obviously, because of who we are and what this show is about, on just what you wrote about. And I wanted to talk to you about what were the different unions, what were their different approaches to dealing with Amazon, and what were they trying to accomplish?
There were essentially two different approaches, Chris. One, the construction trade unions and 32BJ were involved even before the Amazon deal was announced by Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio, and they were working with the developer of the site in Long Island City, and the construction unions got the developer to promise, you know, to build union, and 32BJ got the developer to promise that, as is promised in many, many projects getting city subsidies, promised to have unionized security guards and janitors under Local 32BJ of the Service Employees International Union. So the construction trades and Local 32BJ, which has over 150,000 members, you know, had this deal with the developer. And then when the Amazon deal was announced, Amazon agreed to use unionized construction workers and have 32BJ union janitors and security guards at its site. So, the construction trades and 32BJ were pretty happy. So the deal is announced, and then the state AFL-CIO and the retail wholesale department store union and the Teamsters say, wait, Amazon is this famously anti-union company. It refuses to negotiate in Germany with its strong unions. At some of its warehouses, where there have been unionization efforts, including one in Delaware, it was pretty quick to crush that. So, you know, the Teamsters, the RWDSU, and Mary Cilento, the head of the state AFL-CIO, you know, end up meeting with Amazon officials, and they say, we want neutrality at your new warehouse in Staten Island. Amazon has
neutrality.
Amazon has built a $100 million fulfillment center warehouse with 2,500 employees, and the unions were demanding that neutrality be granted, meaning that Amazon would not fight against, you know, would sit on its hands and not fight against the unionization effort. And Amazon, in the city council hearing in late January, said, no go, we're not going to accept neutrality.
And that was a huge moment. That moment, I mean, that really blew up a lot of the opposition in terms of when the fellow from Amazon testified at the city council, correct?
Absolutely. City council member Jimmy Von Bramer, who represents the district in Long Island City where Amazon was going to set up, said, shame on you. You're a union bust. This is all union busting. So, and that kind of, Amazon didn't feel great about that because Amazon wants to feel welcome where it's coming to. And Amazon feels it's being the hero by promising to set up 25,000 jobs. And a lot of people say, great about the 25,000 jobs, but we don't think it's great that the city and the state have agreed to $3 billion in subsidies and incentives. Plus, a lot of community groups are very worried that Amazon was going to push up rents. So Governor Cuomo agreed to bring together the heads, you know, the people from these three unions with Amazon. There was a meeting, you know, I guess 8 days ago, Wednesday morning, in the governor's office. The governor, Mary Cilento, head of the state AFL-CIO, Stuart Applebaum, president of the RWDSU, and George Miranda, head of the Teamsters union in New York. And Cuomo says, sorry, neutrality is on the table, but they negotiated an agreement that was kind of very close to neutrality. And that they thought might really enable them to unionize the Staten Island warehouse. And I should point out that Amazon doesn't have one unionized worker, one unionized facility in the whole country among all its fulfillment centers or warehouses. So what was being negotiated in Cuomo's office was that Amazon would agree and the union would agree not, you know, no hostility. They can't, like, call each other's names or really be nasty. Amazon would still have the right to say, we don't think having a union is a good idea. We don't think we need a third party. But Amazon couldn't say, you know, unions suck. Unions only want money. Unions are often corrupt. Kind of do it gingerly, not hostily. And then another big provision that was being negotiated was, you know, generally under American law, under Supreme Court decision, employers have the right to absolutely prohibit any union organizer from setting foot on company property, whether the parking lot or the lunchroom. So it makes it very hard for unions to reach workers. In the governor's office, these union leaders are negotiating with Amazon, where Amazon was tentatively agreeing to give union organizers some access. And that's very important and pretty unusual, actually.
Yep.
And Amazon was also promising not to retaliate against any pro-union workers. So, you know, when I interviewed Stuart Applebaum of the WDSU, when I interviewed George Miranda of the Teamsters, they said, these talks are really going pretty well. There was no hostility, and we thought we were going to have, you know, we were sending it to our lawyers, to our wordsmiths, and we thought we'd have a deal very soon. So that was Wednesday morning, and they learned Wednesday night that Amazon is pulling the plug on New York, and they're very, you know, they're pretty upset.
Let me just we're talking with Stephen Greenhouse, former New York Times reporter covering labor, and the author of a book that's coming out in August called Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. You quoted one union strategist in your story in American Prospect on this, the union perspective on the Amazon story. You quoted a union strategist as saying, the labor movement had to decide, are we happy to be a movement on the margins, or do we want to fight for the real pie? Do we stay in the box, or do we fight for the real economic core of the labor market? Given its size, given the fact that nowhere in America is there a unionized Amazon worker, a lot was at stake in this because New York City is a labor town, right?
Absolutely. So Amazon, as I said, was going to allow the janitors and security guards at its building to be unionized, but they would not be directly employed by Amazon. They'd be by a contractor. Did it with the construction trade unions. You know, it was going to allow the construction work to be unionized, up to 5,000 workers, but again, none of them were direct Amazon employees. And when I interviewed, you know, this fairly senior labor official, he said, you know, It's nice that we have this unionization at the margins among the janitors, security guards, and construction workers, but we have to really unionize, you know, get to the belly of the beast, you know, really unionize inside Amazon. And Amazon is now the nation's second largest private employer after Walmart. Right. And Amazon is, you know, arguably the most influential company in the country right now, the way it's, you know, having such huge effects on retailers across the country, on tech across the country. So, you know, I think unions say in New York, a very union-heavy, progressive city, that we should really confront Amazon here and really try to make gain a foothold inside Amazon. So that Wednesday night, so the unions and the negotiations at Cuomo's office were fairly confident that things are going right. And then Wednesday night, the union leaders are pretty shocked to learn that Amazon's pulling the plug. And it's unclear why. Was it because of the protests from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other lawmakers? Was it all the opposition from community groups? Or was it that Amazon did not want to give unions the least foothold? And afterwards, I think, you know, some unions criticized the state FFAO, the RWDSU, and the Teamsters for, like, they helped create such a hostile atmosphere that Amazon pulled out, and we, New York, are losing 25,000 jobs. On the other hand, some of the, you know, like the RWDSU criticized Local 32BJ for supporting Amazon's deal, because the construction trades and 32BJ praised Amazon for coming to town, and they endorsed the deal. And the unions that were demanding neutrality said that those unions shouldn't have been so quick to endorse the deal. They should have held off to help the overall labor movement get more leverage to demand neutrality. Now, the problem is, with 250 cities around the country courting, wooing Amazon, Amazon could say, well, if New York in the first instance was demanding neutrality or showed that it was flexing some union muscle, they'd say, screw New York, let's go pick another city. Let's pick Austin, Texas. Let's pick Dallas. Let's pick Houston. Let's pick Miami. So it's really hard in this competition where all these cities are brandishing, tons of incentives for a city to really put its labor foot forward and say, we're willing to offer you $3 billion incentives, but we want you to also agree to neutrality. New York has, I think it's no coincidence that Amazon picked New York, even despite the subsidies, because it wants to be in a great city with a great human capital, with lots of smart tech people, lots of smart advertising people, lots of smart media people, because I thought, I think Amazon thought that would really help them overall. But, and it wanted to be welcomed as a hero. And when labor started flexing its muscles somewhat, when, progressives were saying, we don't want Amazon, it's a bad company, it's a bad employer, Amazon kind of said, screw you. We thought we should be hailed and welcomed, but instead you're making us look bad, and we're going to, as Mayor de Blasio said, they just picked up their ball and went home.
And Hector Figueroa, who is the head of 32BJ, the Service Workers Union, went straight to the op-ed page of the Daily News and said, we're cutting off our nose to spite our face. Amazon's pullout will be bad for the very workers that opponents of the deal claim to care about. So that, what I'm thinking is that beyond New York, and there are all sorts of issues about whether or not, what Amazon thought they were getting into when you come to New York. As you say, there are all those pluses. And then there is, I remember when Pathmark tried to open a supermarket on 125th Street 25 years ago. It took years for Pathmark to work through the city process and to get all the buy-in that they needed. And there was a lot of protest at that time. And then when Pathmark closed many years later, there was protest about the closing of Pathmark. This is a city that's the way this goes down. But in terms of the long-term strategy of how do you unionize Amazon, that's something that we're going to be wrestling with and struggling with for years, I believe.
I agree. Amazon had come to New York,
Steve, I just got to tell you, we got about 45 seconds left.
Okay. If Amazon had come to town, that really might have, given labor some real opportunity to try to pressure Amazon and unionize its facility in Staten Island. Hector Figueroa, who's no dummy, asked, well, now that we chased away Amazon, now that we're not going to get these 25,000 jobs, is that really going to help the union movement, if Amazon moves to Nashville or expands in Virginia, is it going to be any easier to unionize there than here? And he sees it as a total loss, while many progressives say this is a huge victory because we've sent a signal to this anti-union employer that often treats workers very badly. We've sent a strong signal that we, New York City, the greatest city in the world, don't want you.
Stephen Greenhouse is the author of Beaten Down, Working Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Thank you very much for being on, and that's the show. Okay, till next time, ciao.